listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2014 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud.
The year was 1966, and some 2 hours north of where we sit today, marchers congregated along the side of Highway 99 in Central California. In an effort to bring La Causa to national consciousness, they embarked on a pilgrimage that would take them from Delano, the birthplace of the farmworkers' strike, northward to Sacramento. A young playwright and compadre of Cesar Chavez named Luis Valdez, founder of Teatro Campesino, delivered a passionate speech inside a local hall in a town along the route of the march. This, quote, "This is the beginning of a social movement. We draw our strength from the very despair in which we have been forced to live. Our revolution will not be armed, but we want the existing social order to dissolve. Our pilgrimage is the match that will light our cause for all farm workers to see what is happening here so that they may do as we have done." We are honored to have with us tonight the same man who shared these words, who, from that moment on, walked in solidarity with the movement. Luis Valdez lent his life and talent to the Teatro, a theater group organized in the fields themselves, performing actos, or skits, by and for the workers, to educate, empower, and ease their burden. Just as Chavez improvised his tactics, Teatro Campesino improvised their skits, using humor to stage plays in the flatbed of a truck or on the picket lines. And to provide context to these moments of history is author Miriam Powell, whose new book, The Crusades of Cesar Chavez, is the first ever comprehensive biography of Chavez to date. Reflecting some 10 years of research and study, Powell's book is a fascinating and nuanced look at the complexity of this American hero, deemed a saint by some, whose indelible mark on history extends to postage stamps and whose words have been adopted as a presidential campaign slogan, "Si se puede." Why is it now, 21 years after his passing, that the first comprehensive biography of Chavez was published, the first feature film made? Who gets to reconstruct a history? How do the artist and writer balance the moral, creative, and ethical integrity of their work against the social demands of the movement, the weight of a legacy, the influence of a family? And how has the story changed to shape our world, leaving a vehicle and voice for migrants today to speak their truth? We will miss the participation of film producer Pablo Cruz, who was unable to be with us for tonight's discussion, but I do encourage you to see the film, which was released just last Friday. And taking from the content of tonight's conversation, you can patch together for yourself a deeper understanding of Cesar Chavez. Prior to writing The Crusades of Cesar Chavez, Miriam Powell authored The Union of Their Dreams, Power, Hope, and Struggle in Cesar Chavez's Farm Worker Movement. She is a Pulitzer Prize-winning editor and reporter who spent 25 years working for Newsday and the Los Angeles Times. In addition to founding Teatro Campesino, Luis Valdez is known for Zoot Suit, the first Chicano play on Broadway and a box office hit in Los Angeles, premiered here in 1978 right up Grand Avenue at the Mark Taper Forum. His numerous feature film and television credits include, among others, La Bamba, Cisco Kid, and Corridos, Tales of Passion and Revolution, for which he won a Peabody Award. And moderating our conversation tonight is Laura Pulido, Associate Professor of American Studies and Ethnicity at USC. Pulido's research focuses on race, political activism, and Chicana-Chicano studies. She has done extensive work in the field of environmental justice and social movements, including a master's thesis on the early pesticide campaign of the United Farm Workers Organizing Committee. So let's get to the conversation. Please help me in welcoming our guest tonight to the Aloud stage at the Los Angeles Public Library.
Thank you. Everyone here okay? Yeah? Good. Thank you for the generous introductions, Maureen. As you know, we're very fortunate to have with us today two incredible writers and, do I call you a scholar, just a writer?
Writer and independent scholar.
Okay, there we go. All right. Writer, independent scholar, as well as the artist Luis Valdez, to talk about Cesar Chavez, the UFW. One of the things that I thought we would do to start off is I just thought I'd ask our panelists to spend a few minutes just talking about what brought them. In the case of Miriam, what brought her to the story of the UFW and Cesar Chavez? And asking Luis, what brought you to the man and to the UFW itself in terms of your own personal experience?
Well, I came backwards into the history from the present, really, and I was a reporter at the LA Times and did a series about the United Farm Workers Today and became very curious about the history because the UFW Today had sort of withdrawn so far from the field and I wanted to understand why. So I started talking to people who were veterans of the heyday of the movement. Initially, I thought just to understand the present and put it into context. And then I really was drawn and ultimately drawn to write the biography of Cesar Chavez by the people around him and by people like Luis in the sort of remarkable group that kind of came together in the early years of the strike and the movement. And I wanted to understand that my first book was about those people primarily because I wanted to understand what was this force that had really changed their lives and been such an incredibly important force in their lives. So I did that book, and then that answered some questions, but ultimately I wrote this book because no one else had written a biography, and I thought he was too important a historical figure for that not to be the case.
Right, thanks.
Well, in talking about Cesar, I can't help but talk about my life, because my relationship with Cesar actually bridges practically my whole life. Well, he's been dead now for 20 years. But his spirit continues to influence, I think, not just me, but a lot of us. And in order to understand what I'm saying, I think we need to go back and take a real strong look at California. I was born in 1940. And in 1940, the population of California was 6 million people. And it was basically white Anglo-Saxon and Protestant. There were maybe 750,000 Mexican-Americans. So we were really a minority. All the colored peoples were minorities. And that meant that if you were a farm worker, if you were a migrant farm worker, you probably knew a lot of people because we were families that knew families. And as it happens, I was born in a labor camp in Delano. I say, tell people I was born in Highway 99, you know, because the Highway 99 poured, ripped right through the west side and cleaned out Little Mexico and there was a labor camp that was a part of it, and that's where I was born, in my grandmother's cabin. And in 1941, a year after I was born, a family arrived from Arizona, and my grandmother's sister lived across the street from that labor camp, and they had two shacks. And so they rented one of them to this family. It was a Chavez family with two teenagers. And one was Richard, known as Rookie, and the other was, Monsi, as the movie mentions, but also later CC, as he became a little cooler, more teenager, more pachuco, right? But I didn't know that at the time, but our families intersected. When I was 6 years old, I had a cousin by the name of Billy Miranda who lived with us from time to time. And he was running partners with Cece and Richard. And they were pachucos on the west side of Delano. They used to come over to the house. My first exposure to pachucos was in our house with these pachucos that would come over with Billy. I don't know if that influenced how I viewed Pachucos later on when I wrote Zoot Suit, you know, that giant figure. But one of them was, in fact, Cece, who turned out to be... when I went, I told my mother I'm going back to Delano to work with the United Farm Workers. She said, oh, you're going to work with Cece? And I said, that vato's still around? And she says, mijo, don't you know who Cece is? He's Cesar Chavez. And so I mentioned all this to Rich, to Cesar when I came, because he suspected I was a communist. I'd been to college. I graduated the year before in 64, the degree in English. I'd been working in the San Francisco Mime Troupe, but I'd been to Cuba the summer of 64 and met Che Guevara and played baseball with Fidel. And so I was totally politicized. And I knew that I had to do something to alleviate the injustices that I had experienced as a kid, as a farm worker. So I chose to try to start a theater up by for farm workers, and I pitched it to Cesar, and he allowed me to come to Delano. But he wanted to know what my background was, so my link was Billy. And because I was Billy's cousin, he said, oh, yeah, okay. So we had a family connection. Half of the strikers were, half of my family were strikers, and the other half were scabbing. You know, they were breaking the strike in the Delano area. So it was a very personal experience for me. Coming back to work with Cesar was like coming back to work with a big brother, and he was like a family member for me.
Thanks. Great. So right now we know there's like books coming out by Steve Pitty, Matt Garcia, Miriam's, of course. There's the film out that's right now. And I know Caesar's Last Fast is coming out, I think, like later on this month, right? So it's kind of like becoming a little cottage industry. So I guess the question is, like, why now? Why is this happening at this particular point in time, do you think?
I mean, I think some of it is simply the passage of time and that there's enough time that has elapsed that it is considered history. And some people who were reluctant to talk about events that had happened at that point in time are more willing to now, because a lot of what happened toward the end of the movement, people did not have very pleasant experiences. So to some degree, I think the passage of time makes it seem like it's history. People are more concerned that the other problem, the reason people are talking about it and the reason that scholars like myself, I think, are looking at it is because nobody knows who Cesar Chavez is today. If you go to Salinas and you talk to high school kids, they haven't heard of him. If you go to New York, forget it. You know, there was a TV report last night. The reporter went to Olvera Street, which is right down here, and was asking people if they knew who Cesar Chavez was, and they didn't. So, you know, that was a lot of my motivation, and I think to some degree that of other people as well, is that if these books aren't written now and there aren't works for people to study and examine and debate, then Cesar's legacy becomes really lost.
Well, let me ask you this, though. You say that people don't know, but here in California, this is like a state holiday. So how do you reconcile that?
That's a good question. I mean, the curriculum is not very good. Look, there has been for a long time, you know, it's true. I mean, I've read the California curriculum on Cesar Chavez, and it is about the most bland, milquetoast, sort of, you know, expurgated version of the story that you can get. And you know, I think that there has been a tremendous sort of protectiveness about his legacy, and a lot of this comes from his family in particular, and a sort of desire to portray him as such a saintly figure that he becomes not all that interesting, frankly, because, you know, one-dimensional people don't have a whole lot of depth. So I think there's been a sort of sense of a fear that the people who knew how complicated the story was have not wanted to take it on for fear of tarnishing the legacy. And you know, I think that's a foolish fear, and that in some ways has backfired because it has sort of rendered him to be a whole lot less important than he should be.
Yeah, yeah. Any thoughts on that?
Well, time allows you to get a perspective, and not everybody knows. For instance, I mean, I talked to Cesar about creating a film based on his life for about 10 years before he died. I started conceiving myself as a filmmaker on the picket line. Cesar put me in charge of all the documentary film crews that were coming to Delano and got into some of those documentaries myself, you know, some of the earliest shots of the huelga. But the thing is that after Zoot Suit became a feature, my first feature, I thought maybe there's a possibility here. You know, he saw the movie. Maybe he's convinced. He wasn't convinced, you know. he was really quite reluctant. And after La Bamba, I said, surely now, you know. and he still was not. And my last attempt was in 1992, a few months before, about a year before he died, with Fred Ross, who also died 6 months before Caesar. Fred Ross had written a wonderful book called Conquering Goliath about Caesar's early campaign. And so Fred and I schemed together to try to convince Caesar. So we took the trek all the way to La Paz and sat down with Caesar to try to convince him. And he knew we were coming. He knew we wanted to talk to him about making a movie. So he met us in the middle of this lunch with all kinds of families and farm workers and kids running in a bench, you know, right in the middle of all this chaos. It was his way to avoid having to give us an answer. Mm-hmm. And he couldn't say no to Fred. And he could say no to me, but but not to Fred. But I've never seen him so conflicted.
And I it goes to his desire for control, I think, right? Would you agree with that? That
he did not want to relinquish his own image. He was his own creation. We'll come to that. I hope we'll talk about that. But certainly a movie is turning yourself over to somebody else. And then somebody in Hollywood, he distrusted Hollywood. He knew that somebody was going to make money. And I said, well, you know, he said it's too much story. And I said, you're right. You're right. Maybe we should do a miniseries in television. And he said, no, a movie would be better. But still, no movie. Okay, so when he died, I was in Mexico, traveling with the president of Mexico, actually. That day that he died in San Luis, I was in Hermosillo, a few miles away. And I had been that day traveling with the president of Mexico, Salinas de Gortari, the guy that launched NAFTA. And we started on the Guatemalan border, you know, with the Rio Sumacinta, the Sumacinta River, in a 727 called Emiliano Zapata, and then flew to Puebla and hopped onto a Benito Juarez 747, and then made it all the way to Sonora, to Hermosillo. And he was dedicating hospitals all the way along. And I was there trying to talk to him about more Chicano-Mexican cooperation making movies. That's happening now. It's happening now. That's why this movie got made. But at that time, it was new. It wasn't happening. And anyway, he died. And I was suddenly caught with, overwhelmed with grief. I joined the family in setting up the march, you know, his burial, all of that. And then the following week, my agent calls me and said, someone's trying to sell the Cesar Chavez movie in town here in L.A. You better get down here. So I came, and against my impulse, I had to pitch the movie to somebody. So I pitched it to Warner's. And got a deal, actually, to develop. And for the next 4 years, I worked on 14 different drafts of the movie and had to deal with the family. Yes, I was an insider. And yes, I knew some of the reality of what had happened. And I was trying to dramatize that.
But that was your problem.
The family did not want that. A lot of what Miriam has gone into in the book was part of my screenplay. I read it to the family. I read it to Dolores. I read it to Helen, all of them. In their union headquarters, and they did not want that story to be told. Now it didn't get made, so no one knows what I'm talking about. You know,
that's why I had
to
write
like a great movie. You know, but maybe it was a terrible movie. But the fact is that at the time, this is the 1990s, early 1990s, there was no Michael Peña. The only candidate that was out was Antonio Banderas. That was it. The same thing happened with the Frida Project. There was no Salma Hayek. There was no Jennifer Lopez when I was doing it. So it, really, Hollywood wants to know who's going to star in it. And there was only Antonio Banderas. 20 years later, Michael Peña.
Right, but the real problem is that they did not trust you enough in order to let you make the movie.
They were protecting the legend,
right.
Okay? Yeah. And was it? It was John Ford that said, you know, when you have to decide between the truth and the legend. You print the legend.
Right.
That's what happened. That's what's happening with Caesar, is that the legend, I'm not putting it down. I think the legend is very, very useful. I think we need the legend. We need heroes. We need heroes, and we need them to be what Caesar has become, a giant, you know? But what they wanted, what the union wanted, what the family wanted, was a hagiography. And that that is the story of a saint.
So it's really not the question of trust so much as having a different interpretation.
Well, right.
And how you would do.
And being committed to that hagiography, which they got in the Diego Luna movie. That's what they got, is they found someone who would make the movie and allow them to have complete control. And the result is that it's the family's movie. But the you know, I think the legend is important too, but I think the legend was more important in Caesar's lifetime when he was using it toward an end. So, I mean, he created in many ways his own mythology, and I talk about that a lot in the book, of the sort of way he shaped his story mm-hmm. in ways that lots of good organizers do, where you change the truth a little bit because it's in the interest of doing something, achieving some goal.
Yeah.
But I think he also recognized that once he was dead, that someday, at some point, the real story was going to come out. And that, I mean, he was a student of history. He was self-taught. He read tremendous amounts. And I think he understood that true historic figures are much more complicated than that. And he saved, and we can get to this quickly.
Yeah, I was going to ask you.
You know, he saved, he from 1967 on, he made an agreement with the preeminent labor library in the country, which is in Detroit. I've spent many, many, many weeks in Detroit, Michigan. And he saved not only papers, but audio tapes. He taped extensively from 1969 about until 1980. He taped all of the board meetings. He taped these meetings that went on for hours and hours and hours, and just these sort of agonizing deliberations at some points in time. And you just see him in all, you see him being sort of nurturing and being profane and being pragmatic and being strategic. And he lied to people about the fact that he was saving the tapes because people who were on them, you know, didn't really want them preserved. So, I mean, I should say he lied, but the people would say, "Are you saving the tapes?" And he said, "No, no, we tape over them. We're just doing it for the minutes of the meetings, and then we reuse them." And, you know, there are these hundreds of boxes of tapes in Wayne State. So I think that he, you know, on some levels, whether he recognized how he was going to be portrayed in them or not, he wanted the real story. I mean, he took a lot of steps to keep material so that the actual story could be told as opposed to the legend, and they could, you know, coexist in some form.
I think that profile, you know, it appears in the movie, is misleading to this extent, that the roots of the personality of Cesar Chavez are embedded in his life as a Chicano, mm-hmm. okay? He was born in 1927. And Arizona to California. He came to California as a teenager. He was a pachuco, man. Okay, he was a zoot suiter. And to the end of his life, he was a Miles Davis fan. He played John Coltrane. This was his music. He was a jazz aficionado. He knew what marijuana was because he smoked it at one point. We want to get that fact out. The family doesn't want that fact to get out. But, you know, he and his cousin Manuel, that Miriam goes to in his book, you know, Manuel was a very different personality. Manuel was cool. Manuel was potentially violent, you know. And I knew that. I saw that. We all saw that. Richard was in between. Richard was really a tremendous great heart and soul, you know.
Richard was his brother.
Richard was his brother. But he was, like, optimistic, always forward-looking, hard-working, a carpenter. You know, he built the first buildings of the 40 acres with his own hands. I mean, he mortgaged his house, you know, so Caesar could buy the 40 acres. But the fact is that underneath the iconic farm labor leader is not a campesino, it's an urban type. It is Caesar Chavez, the Chicano, being able to scope out the power structure of California agriculture and knowing where to strike.
And creating his image. I mean, you are actually one of the first people who talked to me about that, about the suffering on the march to Sacramento, which Maureen talked about in her introduction, the fact that he refused to put on more comfortable shoes.
At the start,
Because he sort of leaned into the suffering, was your term, and I think I adopted that, because it was part of the image. And then even later, in later years, when he was flat on his back, he would do interviews in his bed in pajamas. And it was this sort of, you know, he really was able to maximize, I think, the political value and leverage. He understood that, right?
We met, actually, in a house in Santa Barbara to plan the march to Sacramento. This is like called the little winter in agriculture, because their crops have all been picked, and they're really ready to bud again, and the pruning has all been done, so there's nothing for farm workers to do. So Caesar planned on this march. And in order to plan it, he took a group of us, that were his close circle at the time, to this house in Santa Barbara, on the beach, and we planned the March to Sacramento. And one of the things that came out immediately was from Father Kennedy in Sacramento, the theme, Peregrinación, Penitencia, Revolución. Pilgrimage, Penance, and Revolution.
And it was during Lent.
Yes, and that came out, and I found it a little weird.
Penance was big.
Isn't the life of the farm worker penance enough? Like, you know, why do we have to suffer some more? You know, but Caesar was already planting the spiritual thing, you know, and of course led by the Virgen de Guadalupe, you know, all of that. And so I went along with it. I mean, I'll go along with it. I went to college, so I was an atheist, I'll admit it, you know. But the union and the struggle actually made me more spiritual. And certainly with the Virgen de Guadalupe, as a Mexican, I couldn't turn my back on her. She was always there. But the thing is that this march, then motivated by spiritual values, was already the planting of a seed and the changing of a profile. When I went to Delano and started working with Caesar, he still smoked. He was a chain smoker, Camel cigarettes, pack after pack. He still drank beer, okay? And he drank wine, and he ate meat. I know because I had dinner at his house. You know, I remember eating some delicious frijoles chinitos. I don't know if you know. The refried beans, okay? And Helen cooked them, and it was an honor for me to eat these refried beans at his table, you know? But the fact is that this was, you know, Mexican food. Well, along the way, Caesar stopped eating Mexican food. Along the way, he stopped smoking. Along the way, he stopped drinking alcoholic beverages. That's perhaps the most interesting part of his story, is that this Chicano transformed into this figure, into this spiritual type, as Gandhi-esque. Where did that impulse come from? From the people around him and from his own exposure to history.
You know what? I'm going to redirect this right here.
Yeah.
This is very interesting. But I want to think about this is something that Miriam talks about. And most scholars do acknowledge this in talking about Chavez and the UFW, is the tensions between it being a movement, right? Mm-hmm. And between labor union and a movement. And when we talk about a movement, there's a couple of ways of thinking about it. There's the Chicano movement, right? And then there's kind of the movement of the farm workers themselves, right? And so I want you guys to comment on that kind of tension and the different ways in which it plays out.
And in fact, I mean, I thought Maureen gave a great introduction, but she called him a labor leader, and I'm not sure I would call him a labor leader per se, and I don't think he considered himself a labor leader in many ways, which was part of what ultimately doomed the union. But he, from the beginning, said we have to be some cross between a movement and a union. I mean, in an interview that he gave in the first week of the grape strike in Delano in 1965, he said we can't be a traditional union. We have to find some cross. And for a long time, he was able to, those two things were able to sort of coexist, and in fact, the movement was what enabled the strike to succeed. I mean, he knew that he couldn't win a strike in the fields of California. I mean, you had an agribusiness empire that controlled everything. So he went outside and he formed these strategic alliances, and the church, which the march was part of getting church support, religious support as well. So they were able to coexist, but at some point in time, suddenly, the union at some point became a victim of its own success, in that when you have a labor union that succeeds and that has contracts and that has hundreds of contracts and thousands of members who want things and who want demands and expect to have service from their union, then you've created a whole bureaucracy, and he had no interest in that fundamentally. So you get, again, on these tapes, these kind of deliberations between him and his brother, among others, you know, Richard, who was very practical and who said, well, we're a labor union now and we have to do things to operate as a union. And Richard would even say, we can't be a movement and a union both. But Richard's answer was, we need to be a union. And Caesar's answer was, if it comes to that, we have to be a movement. So I think in his concept of movement, he was not a big fan of the Chicano movement at the time. He ultimately became, in some ways, the face of it. But for him, movement was something spiritual. It was about poor people being not poor. He wanted people to be comfortable, but he also wanted them to not adopt middle-class values. I mean, he talks, and this goes back to things that we haven't talked about yet, which his training as an organizer, his 10-year experience with the Community Service Organization and Fred Ross, where he empowered people, and once he empowered them, they decided they wanted to be middle-class, and they wanted television sets, and they wanted to play golf, and he thought that was just horrendous. So a lot of the issues and the tensions within the union and the union movement things start to stem from his desire that workers be educated to want to sacrifice for others. Well, you know, a lot of workers wanted to make more money and be able to buy color television sets. So there's a lot of tension that develops along the way.
As Luis said, life was hard enough for them.
Exactly.
Well, I think, I mean, the Caesar's strength rises from his life. As a migrant farm worker, he toured the whole state. So he knew people in San Jose, he knew people in Oxnard, he knew people in Los Angeles, he knew people in the San Joaquin Valley, you know, from one end to the other. That set him up to become the CSO organizer, then going to all these different towns and organizing CSOs. And when he set out to organize the union, he knew people in all these different communities, you know. But again, the idea of a labor union, because he was a child of the 20s and the 30s, was very foremost in his mind. I think he really believed that a union was absolutely necessary. Certainly, it's a wage struggle, trying to augment the wages, you know, get people together around an economic issue. But if you've ever looked at California agriculture, you know, it was an impossible job. I mean, it was, I'm not saying no se puede, but it was an impossible job. It was like you're facing the multi-billion dollar industry, one of the major pillars of the state of California. And these people have power. And it's not as if there hadn't been other strikes. My dad and my grandfather were in the 33 Pixley strike where they killed farm workers. And they saw, you know, the killing of the farm workers. In 1948, when I was 8 years old, we had Ernesto Galarza led a strike right there in Delano and Early Mart, right there at the Sierra Vista Ranch. And I'd be vaguely aware that was happening. So when 1965 rolls around, Caesar was trying to do again what so many others before had failed to do.
But he succeeded.
He succeeded because it was the 1960s, okay? And the movie doesn't treat this at all. But when I went to Delano, quite frankly, I went as a Chicano, okay? I was born in Delano.
But you were but one of the few also. There were not a lot of Chicanos who went back to Delano in the strike.
No, there were not at the beginning.
You were an
there
exception.
Were not, actually, yeah. There were a lot of Anglo volunteers out there, a lot of students, a lot of radicals from Berkeley and L.A. And the movie doesn't cover that. The people that surrounded Caesar were Jim Drake, you know, his administrative assistant from the migrant ministry, Chris Hartmeyer, which you mentioned in the book. To this day, I mean, there are people that have helped the union.
Leroy Chatfield.
Leroy Chatfield, you know, who was Brother Gilbert when I met him. He was a Christian brother, but he turned into Leroy Chatfield. I mean, this Bill Escher, who was the editor of El Malcriado. And Bill Escher, after he left Delano, went to join the Bhagwan Rajneesh, you know, up in Oregon. I mean, he was on a spiritual quest. And so he looked on Caesar as a spiritual being as well. We used to have conversations in the Malcriado when our misgivings started to come through about what should we do. And we kind of agreed that when you could no longer take it, then it was our responsibility to resign, to leave, not to counter the union, not to counter Caesar, but to get out. And so that was eventually Bill Escher left. Now, the thing is that we weren't doing the struggle. We were there to help Caesar. It wasn't our struggle. It was a farm worker struggle. He was the leader. And the fact is that he was brilliant. You know, we had confidence in his confidence. He was turning it into a game with his cronies, you know, and he was able to really deal with the growers without fear. And that's what I really loved about it. I mean, the guy was courageous. He was taking on these growers that we had all feared for so long.
You know what? But Luis, when you say this, and this is back to earlier what you were saying too about the image that, and you talk about in the book that he cultivates. So, what extent is that image he's cultivating playing into this? To what extent is it facilitating?
But if the image is aimed at the outside world at that point in time, it's no longer. I mean, it becomes an image that's important for the boy. I mean, what wins the strike is the boycott. Okay, mm-hmm. I mean, that's what wins the contracts in 1970. It's not, you know, it's the supermarket chains across the country that say to the growers, we don't want to put up with the boycott anymore. So, I mean, that ultimately, he does do this thing that is absolutely incredible. I mean, he starts in 1962 with nothing, right? He goes to these little towns that Luis is describing and organizes people one by one, basically, which is what he was brilliant at doing. And then he takes on this, you know, this thing that has never been done, and he wins. And then is the problem of having to actually run the union that has been created.
Well, again, you need to understand Caesar as a Chicano. What does that mean? And again, as a sociologist, if you look at the history of Mexican-American history, the breakdowns are a little confusing because we say Chicano, 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 and we don't make the distinction. Japanese Americans, for instance, number their generations. Isi, Nisi, you know. Sansei, Yonsei, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, and up to six now. There's six generations. And the Issei are very clearly the people that arrived, the first immigrants, you know. And then the Nisei are their children. And then the Sansei are the children of the children. And then the Yonsei are the children of the children of the children, and so forth. Well, Chicanos are the same way, you know. But the real Chicano in Caesar's family was his father, Librado, who was the son of Cesario, the grandfather. And he was born in Mexico, but he grew up here. And then Caesar was Chicano number two, you see? And Chicano came in the 40s. He matured in the 40s with jazz music and the Chicano, the Pachuco thing, the foundations of the Chicano identity that surfaced a generation later in the 1960s. And so it was because he arrived in the 1960s, he was able to tap into not just the new left, which was at Berkeley and at UCLA and in all the colleges and was ready to help Caesar. He was also able to tap into a lot of young Chicanos that saw themselves as a new generation, unlike their parents, ready to fight for this ground, you see?
And so
that needs to be understood. Chicano 1, 2, 3, 4 in terms of the Chicano community. But Caesar was most definitely an American. Caesar was most definitely a Chicano. Caesar was most definitely urban and rural. You got to understand that. He was bourbon and rural. This is why he could relate to New York. This is why when he threw extravaganza in New York City, he took over Madison Square Garden, you know? I mean, that is amazing. No Chicano had ever done that. To have a big fundraiser at Madison Square Garden, take it on. He took it on.
But that goes to your question about his image and the way in which he used his image, I think.
Yeah,
and the boycott, you know, I mean, I don't know how many people here even remember the boycott or know anything about it to begin with, but, you know, I mean, a lot of boycotters, okay.
A few boycotters.
All right. So, but the boycott, particularly outside of California, you know, the boycott was Mexican farm workers who had never been outside of California, who had never been on planes, some of them didn't speak English, going to cities around the country with nothing and being told to stop the sale of grapes. And the fact that it succeeded was stunning.
It was amazing. Yeah.
It was amazing. And it succeeded because of his force of personality and his strategy and because he gave people who were great organizers in their own right a chance to experiment and see what they could do and figure things out. But it was also a lot because he was able to form these alliances, which again is not in the movie and I think is one of the problems. I don't think you can see the movie and understand the boycott because the boycott was about the religious groups and the labor groups and all of the people and the students and people around the country who helped those farm workers, and the farm workers became the face. So somebody could say, you know, I'm 19 years old and I'm a farm worker from Delano and I just came across the country and moved my family. Could you please stop eating grapes to, you know, help me have a better life and help get contracts? And Caesar's image changed. You know, there's a little detail that he talks about on one of the tapes where he wrote a constitution in 1962. So in 1962, he moved to Delano and he formed the Farm Workers Association and had the first convention in September of 1962, which was remarkable also. I mean, moving there with nothing in April and by September, he can have 300 people who are willing to vote to pay dues to join this organization that he's created. He wrote the Constitution for the farm workers, the first Constitution, okay? So preamble, thank you. The preamble to the Constitution is about farm workers and it's written for them. By 1973, when the UFW becomes a formal AFL-CIO union and he has to write the next Constitution, the preamble is written for the outside world. Because that's the part of the Constitution he thinks people will read, and that's the part of the Constitution that he's counting on to help raise money. I mean, the UFW never, ever, ever to this day, survived based on the money that was paid by its members' dues. It always, you know, depended on outside funds from the labor movement, from individuals, from other institutions. So his image becomes, you know, changes as he needs to figure out ways to succeed.
I want to switch directions here because you're pointing out some of the tensions and problems with the union itself, not the movement, but with the union and its functioning. And I want to bring us into the contemporary period and talk about the current situation of farm workers in California, especially perhaps, you know, in the Central Valley. And what is the current status? You know, Miriam, for some of you who don't know, she did a very extensive investigative series for the LA Times on California farm workers in the 90s?
Yes? In 2006.
Okay.
Yeah, more recent.
And so tell us some about that, and why did we get to the state? I know, like, my mother, she knows I did, like, my dissertation work on the UFW, and she says, well, I don't understand. Wasn't there Cesar Chavez? You know, ¿qué pasó? You know, so can you...
Right, either people have never heard of Cesar Chavez, or they assume that the UFW is representing farm workers, right?
The problems have been solved, and what do you mean they're not solved, right?
And that was really, you know, what led me to write the series for the LA Times, because I assumed that, too, when I was living in New York, and you know, I grew up not eating grapes. I did. I was a boycott supporter, not a boycotter, but a boycott supporter. You know, the reason I wrote the stories was because when I started to cover agriculture for the LA Times, and someone told me, you know, I went around to meet people who were involved in agriculture and in related, you know, support groups. And when someone told me that there were farm workers in San Diego living in caves in hillsides in the side of the hill, I mean, I didn't believe it. It was like, you know, this is 2005. We're in the 21st century. There can't be farm workers living in caves. And, you know, not only were they living there, but everybody knew it. And it had been going on in San Diego forever. And, you know, every couple of years, the paper would do a story about, you know, the farm workers are there. And the only thing that changed was that as development encroached, I mean, you could see Legoland from the canyon where they were living, you know, and you look up and see the fireworks at night. And there are these people who are drinking water out of irrigation pipes and building their, you know, houses within. And a handful of people who are trying to help, who come and bring food to them. And it was, you know, it's sort of, for people who don't know that that's going on, it's pretty incredible. So that's the condition. I mean, not all farm workers live like that. There is a lot less migrancy than there used to migrant workers. There's a lot more sort of, because the nature of agriculture has changed in part, so there are a lot more people who don't have to move around as much as was the case then. But the conditions, you know, and the UFW has a handful of members and basically is a political lobbying group and does not organize farm workers. And never got outside of California, even sort of in its heyday.
Right.
So the way you have to understand that, I mean, the farm worker situation in California, throughout the United States, is compromised completely by the unlimited supply of cheap stoop labor that's available in Mexico. Mm-hmm. There's still too many people that are willing to come. So setting up a union with unlimited scabs ready to break it is quite a quandary for Caesar to be in. And he had to resort to spiritual solutions. We needed a miracle, really, to be able to get through it. But the fact is that Conquering Goliath, Fred Ross's book, was really about Caesar dealing with the Bracero program in 1958 in Oxnard. He saw a huge Bracero program. The Bracero program started in the 1940s, 1942, with World War II, to bring in guest workers to help the war effort. But it continued until 1964. So after the war ended, the growers said, let's keep it going, because it was cheap. It was cheap labor. And the Braceros got screwed in a number of different ways. Some of them didn't get paid. They used to take a certain amount of money for their retirement, and they never saw it, and that kind of stuff. But the fact is that those 20 years of the Bracero program primed the pump on immigration. So no one should complain as to why there are waves of immigrants coming to the United States. It's because they were primed for 20 years. People were coming. And I go to Mexico all the time and meet people that are scholars and, you know, even politicians, and they say, my father was a Bracero. He was over there, you know. And the fact is that it was a reality that Caesar was working against, trying to discontinue, and Dolores also trying to discontinue the Bracero program. It ended in 1964, finally, that made the union possible in 1965. We thought, okay, here's our chance. We're going to be able to cut off scab labor and do a union a struggle and get some contracts. It wasn't possible because growers then went to the border and got undocumented workers. And they were, like, encouraging undocumented workers. The issue is not the workers. The issue was not to condemn, you know, these wetbacks or anything like that. That terminology was used because it was current. That's all. Mojados, you know, we say mojados in Spanish, you know. Alambristas, another, they come under the wire. But the fact is that there was no loss of, there was no hatred toward those workers. As a matter of fact, we watched our language. Instead of talking about mojados, we began to use the term visitantes in the field, you know. These were visitors, and we wanted to encourage these workers to not strike, not work in the strike area. That's all. Go somewhere else. Go to Fresno, but not Delano.
Okay, but you were not around in the 70s when this was going on either. You were doing that. I mean, you were not part of the UFW or organizing at that point in time, right? Because there was, I mean, I will disagree a little on two counts with you on this. You know, one, just as a union, in terms of union organizing, there are plenty of examples of unions that have successfully organized undocumented workers, and the UFW organized undocumented workers. There were elections in 1975 that were won among workers who were undocumented at the time. So, you know, Caesar had a lot of strong feelings about immigrants that come from things like his experience in Oxnard and so on and so forth, but he also, I mean, there's, a wonderful tape where there's this debate about how do we deal with places where we're going to have elections where some of the workers are documented and some are not, and what do we do? And there is a school of thought, and more recently, certainly in the janitors' campaign as an example, and some of the hotel workers as well, where unions have been able to successfully organize among workers who do not have papers because they have, but they have to make the case. I mean, I think that, you know, Caesar at his height and the UFW at its height, what they were so great at that most unions are not very good at, frankly, is giving workers a reason to believe that their future would be better if they joined and supported this organization. And that was the strength of the UFW. And then at some point, he moves away from that because of the movement, tensions and all sorts of other issues that are very complex. But when the UFW no longer, and this is very true today, you know, no longer feels it has to give workers a reason to support them. I mean, I watched, covered a couple of more recent UFW election campaigns in that they lost in 2 or 3 and 4 years ago. And their attitude was, we're the UFW, and if you don't support us, it's either because you're scared, or you're stupid. And the idea that people might need to have a reason to do it other than we are the UFW and we're good, that was somehow was lost. And if you go back to like the DiGiorgio campaign, which was, the first big campaign which the UFW won, that was what the organizers did, right? It was go out and say, here's why you need to support us instead of the Teamsters. And there was a rationale for it.
Well, I think, it gets complicated. Again, the nature of the leadership and the choices that were made, for better or for worse, were made on the spur, depending on how it was. Before, in the first winter in Delano, in the winter of 95, 65. The union headquarters, we had the tiny storefront in Albany, right at the edge of Delano, but we needed a camp. And so the union rented a contractor's camp. It had a Quonset hut, and it had a little dining room on the side, mostly mud, though. And that's where we were. That's the Quonset hut became our store, and Caesar was very distressed because he put people in charge of the store, and we get these shippings of food and clothes coming in, and we try to distribute them equitably, but inevitably, human beings being human beings, whoever was running the store would tell his relatives first, and they would come and get all the good stuff, and so there was a lot of arguments that came from that, just sheer frustration, and Caesar, I know, was very put off by that. The people men didn't want to wash dishes. It was always the women that had to do all the. So Caesar one day went and washed dishes at this camp. Well, anyway, it was getting kind of overwhelming, and in this camp, and it was cold, and we had no money, and Larry Itliong, who was of course the other strike leader,
who's the leader of the Filipino,
invited us all into Filipino Hall, and I remember that was a tremendous gesture. How much I appreciated it. That suddenly we were able to go from this cold, muddy camp to Filipino Hall that had at least had a paved parking lot, and with the Filipino brothers. And we ate in their dining room and had our meetings in their room. And so that was the embrace. And I grew up in Delano, so I know there was racism between the two groups growing up, ugly things that I won't repeat, about people used to say. But we had to overcome that. And the fact is that it came out of this vision that this was a union for everybody. Now, once the emphasis on the spirituality of Virgen de Guadalupe happened, the Filipinos didn't quite understand it in the same way. They say, what is that? What's happening here?
And then once the hiring halls happened, after the contracts were won in 1970, which was this sort of, unheard of victory, and Richard Chavez is left to try to set up a system for running hiring halls for, you know, 150 different contracts. And the Filipinos felt that they were, I mean, there's actually, you know, in one of the very rare occasions when Caesar admits that he'd made a mistake, which he almost never, ever did, you know, many, many years later when he admitted that the administration of these contracts in 1970 was just a disaster and cost the union a lot of support, he said, you know, the Filipinos thought we were corrupt, the Mexicans just thought we were stupid. You know, and because the Filipinos were used to a system and they felt that they were being, you know, so I mean, these are just little examples of the complexities that happen when you start to try to set, I mean, it goes back to your union versus movement.
Well, you're fighting, you know, too. Decades of racism on the one hand, you're trying to overcome that. You're trying to overcome the fact you have no food. You're trying to overcome the fact that, the campesinos are really gut reacting to the strike. You know, they're bread and butter issues. That's what they're concerned about. Right. They don't understand the higher aspect of it.
Sacrificio.
See, the Teatro Campesino, my company, was very helpful. We started staging actos, which were really learning plays in the Brechtian tradition. We had actos about what a contract was. Right. We had actos about what a boycott was. Campesinos didn't understand what a boycott was. What does that mean? So we literally had to dramatize it, you know? In Filipino Hall, here's the boycott. This is how it works. This is why we're sending you to New York and Boston, right? So we were doing straight online educating, you know, with our theater.
And yet by 1967, Caesar was willing to sacrifice the teatro because he felt that you guys were too independent and sort of, being, you know, too strong. So he said that's again a situation where he had to balance the helpfulness of the teatro versus what he saw as his long-term
goal. Yeah, that was unfortunate. You know, the thing
about
Caesar...
Okay, you know what? I'm going to go ahead.
Sorry, we can keep going.
I know this is like all totally interesting and exciting. I'm very interested for myself on the whole question about Filipinos in terms of like the representation imagery of the UFW and how they kind of get left out and all that kind of stuff. But we do have to make time for our audience to ask questions, which I'm sure they have a lot. You've given them a lot of great material and great ideas to respond to. So I want to go ahead and open up to the public if you guys have questions. People are floating around with the microphones.
Hi. So my name is Christian. I'm a student at USC and I'm working on the UFW in Coachella Valley.
Right.
We've met before, Miriam, right. Actually, and I've done a lot of work on the archives in Detroit. And my work is looking specifically on the ways that people are imagining their future. And part of it is through art, through media, through theater, including your work, Valdez. Part of what I understand to be the presumption of the current scholarship on the UFW has to do with the question of why the UFW has fallen from mm-hmm. its position of significant authority within California specifically, and the potential to organize the rest of the country. And one of those things is that Chavez ultimately became a fairly authoritarian leader that did not allow for creative abilities to organize it. But this is a really critical issue because the question is, in 1970 or so, about a third of the workers in the United States were unionized. Now it's 6%. If the entire labor movement in this country has been decimated, how can we pinpoint the UFW's demise to one person?
Well, I mean...
Good question. Thank you.
That's a great question. I mean, we don't know what would have happened. I mean, the UFW could have continued to thrive throughout the 1980s and still be decimated at this point. All we know, you know, as scholars, is what did happen. And what happened was that by, you know, by the mid-1980s, I mean, there were never contracts again in Delano and the Grapes after 1973. So, you know, who knows what would have happened. And certainly there were things. But the point, I think, is that the UFW, you know, Caesar Chavez thrived under the most adverse circumstances, right? So, you know, Ronald Reagan was the governor of California, and Richard Nixon was the president. I mean, he did his best work and his greatest success under the most adverse circumstances.
Yeah, you'd have to look at the leadership. You know, we needed, at that time, we needed more people in the field that could run the hiring hall, that could coordinate contracts. We needed 5 or 6 more Doloreses, you know. We needed 10 Marshall Gantzes, you know, 20 Eliseo Medinas, and we just didn't have them. Now, looking back and looking at you, the benefit of having some education, and now Chicanos and Chicanas getting education, you could have been very useful to the union 40 years ago, okay? but you weren't there.
You know, but the other thing about it, too, though, is to go back to an earlier point, is, like, I almost think it's easier to organize during the Bracero program because at least you could dismantle it. How do you dismantle the globalization of labor that we have seen, right? The way that communities are structured to depend upon this, these immigration flows. I think it's much, much harder to do that. And that's you know, that goes way beyond any one person, you know, in terms of what they can do.
Next question.
Ella, and I'm curious about the class action lawsuit that he filed and why did he file that particular type? What was the name of it, and how did his filing the class action lawsuit play into his winning the grape strike?
I'm not sure.
I'm not sure I know which one.
Which suit you're talking about specifically? Yeah, there were a lot. I mean, you know, what I would say is that the legal strategy was a very important part of the union's success, and an incredible legal team. At the time, and they were able to use the law as a weapon. I mean, Jerry Cohen, who was the chief counsel from 1967 on, you know, he was very complimentary to Caesar in the sense that both of them saw ways to use their opponent's strengths against them, so that they were able to take things that looked like they were protections for the growers and figure out ways to use the legal, you know, to make the law work for them in very innovative and creative ways.
Yeah, Jerry Cohen was a wartime consigliere. He was in the field, you know, and he got beaten, you know, severely and put in the hospital for his services. So, you know, he was there. He was a warrior and young and brilliant, you know, and able to reflect Caesar's moods, you know, to work with it. But even he eventually got compromised, you know. So, you know, what's interesting, I mean, I got purged. I don't know if you know that. I was the first
all
one.
All in the book.
It's in the book. I was one of the first people asked to leave.
It's true.
Now, Caesar didn't ask me directly to leave, which is kind of interesting, all right?
But he never, he used to open all the doors and windows and just wait for people to leave.
That's
that
right.
That was the story. Right.
We were set to go on our first national tour in support of the boycott. I had been invited by Pete Seeger to take the teatro to the Newport Folk Festival. We had performances set up in Washington, New York, and in Washington within the Senate courtyard, sponsored by the two Kennedy brothers, you know, the Senate, Ted and Bobby Kennedy. And we're going to go to Chicago, Denver, the whole country. And so Caesar decided to pick that moment to discipline the teatro. And so I was called into a secret meeting with the board and accused by Caesar of politicking the workers. And what does that mean? It means that I was imposing my ideas on the workers. And I said, that's impossible. When have I done this? What I did do was there were so many people complaining in 1967. It was the result of 2 years of being in the trenches. A lot of the Anglo volunteers were complaining. A lot of campesinos were complaining. And they chose the Teatro Campesino to come bitch, okay? And finally I said one day, why tell me? Tell Caesar, you know? And they were very afraid. And so I said, I tell you what. Caesar trusts me. Why don't I invite him to come over to the teatro and we'll all talk, you know? So I did that. And Caesar came. And it was a mess. It was terrible. It was a real failure. Everybody clammed up. Nobody could speak. None of the campesinos showed up. It was only the Anglo volunteers. And so then Caesar accused me of fomenting unrest in the union. And eventually he started purging people. And then I was called on the carpet, I was told that the theater was being disbanded, that the national tour was off, and that I was going to be sent to Florida. And I said, I'm not going. and I said, if that, but they said it depends on the board. And so there were five members on the board, and the vote was 3-2. Dolores Huerta and Andy Imutan, one of the Filipino leaders, voted in favor of the teatro to go on tour. The other three, Caesar and two other people, one of them was Philip Veracruz, another Filipino striker, friend of mine, I thought, they voted to cancel the tour. And so I said, well, that gives me no choice but to pull the teatro. I said, yeah. We're leaving. I'm not going to counter the union. I'm not going to counter the strike, but we're going to separate. We're going to leave. And he says, what are you going to do? I said, I'm going to set up as an independent entity on my own. And so then I went back to the teatro, and the guys were kind of crestfallen about it, you know, excited, angry, whatever. I got a call, and someone says, we're coming for the Teatro van. And so I said, the Teatro van is in the Teatro's name. It's not in the union's name. So you can't have it, and we're prepared to fight for it. Anyway, people started coming that whole day to our little headquarters, and it was happening. Farm workers wanted to march with me back to the union to counter Caesar. I said, that's no good. We can't do that. But anyway, the whole conversation lasted until 11 o'clock at night. Caesar called me then, and he said, the board has met. Now, when he meant the board, he meant him. The board has met, and we've decided to let you go on the tour. He says, just don't mention anything. I said, Caesar, I won't say anything.
And I just want to say that not that I don't, you know, totally trust Luis's memory on this, because, you know, he has a great memory, but many people have great memories. But in addition to his memory, we have notes that Philip Vera Cruz, one of the Filipino members of the board, took copious notes of these meetings. And so I was able, after he told me this story, to go back and find Philip Vera Cruz's notes that show the vote and also show Caesar saying what had never been publicly said, which was that he believed there was a conspiracy against the union and his leadership. And that's why he was doing this, because that was never the public story and was never known for many years. So the documentation and the real people often...
On the other hand, it must be said that we did, in fact, pull away from the union, but I continued to support, the Teatro Campesino continued to support the union.
Right, and you
said that
a few times.
It continues to support it to this day, okay? Because I believed in the causa, and I was able to separate the man from the causa.
Mm-hmm. One of the few.
Yeah, I wanted to ask a question to Miriam.
Sure.
I haven't read your most recent book, but I read your other writings, and it's very clear that Caesar was a flawed human being, and like many successful historical figures, had control issues. But do you think it's possible for someone with those flaws and control issues to make a net positive contribution to society, because I think that's something that we're missing in maybe some of your writings, the net positive result when you do the math.
I have to read the book.
And
Yes.
So what are the net positive contributions to society that Caesar made?
I totally agree with you. I would not have written a biography. I would not have spent 3 years of my life doing this if I didn't believe that, because there wouldn't be any point to it. And in fact, I don't want to give away the very end of the book, but the epilogue answers that question. Has someone else, but you know, obviously in my stead, addressing exactly that question. And we're all, I mean, I believe that he's a very complex person, but he's heroic. I mean, he's a heroic figure, and I think we have to redefine how we define heroes to some degree. You know, in Greek mythology, heroes are half mortal and half divine, it's their divinity that gives them the power to overcome tremendous obstacles. And yet, it's their mortality, that it's their Achilles' heel, it's their flaws that make them also human and interesting. And you know, of course, his legacy is tremendous, and I say that throughout. I mean, I think that comes through in the book completely. And I know your work, you know, goes to that point.
Part of the compassion, too, towards Caesar is that when La Paz developed, the spiritual center, it was a way for him also to recover his energies. He was spent. Okay, the guy never slept. He worked 24 hours a day. He slept in the car. I used to do imitation of Caesar, you know. This was in the car. We used to laugh about it, but actually it was serious, because I was there. I was there with him, and I know how hard he used to work real hard. He could challenge everybody, but the fact is that I think that when the possibility of La Paz came up, he took it as a way to regenerate himself spiritually, and that separated him. And when he left Delano and went up into the Tehachapi Mountains, there was a separation that occurred. There's no question about it. But I don't think that he could have rekindled his energies any other way. It was impossible for him to stay in Delano, particularly when they were trying to kill him, okay?
But I think he has a tremendous legacy also.
They were out there to kill him. And if you've ever been under that condition, it was on the Delano picket line. I had a loaded gun put to my head by a grower's son, you know, and said, act, go ahead.
But Richard, yep. I just wanted to add one thing, because in my first book was just about the farm worker movement. And yep. so his failure as a union leader in terms of the farm worker movement is one thing. That's only a piece of him. I mean, that's another reason I think I wanted to write this book, because his legacy is something completely different. You know, his legacy is not in the fields, which is unfortunate for farm workers, but he has a tremendous legacy in terms of all of the people he trained and his importance, both as, you know, symbolically and otherwise. So... Absolutely.
I mean, there's how many people know about Emma Temayuca or Luisa Moreno, you know, great labor leaders?
I do.
They're lost in time, right? I mean, right? But the fact is they also struggled once upon a time in the 30s and 40s. But Caesar's remembered because he was able to project his profile.
Right.
He turned himself into an icon because we needed an icon.
Right. Good point. Good point. Last time for one last question.
I just want to know if you are planning to write any books on Dolores Huerta?
I'm not.
So we definitely have time for another question.
Right. Well, that was a short answer.
Yeah, right.
Could you say a little bit more about the direction, that conflict between the union being a union and being a movement, and what direction Cesar Chavez took it? And I'm also curious, I haven't yet, I kept meaning to read, your book is on my list, but I haven't yet read Matt Garcia's book either. And I'm wondering, I mean, break it to me now, I guess, you know, that whole, the portrayal I understand that is in there about Cesar Chavez being, I guess if somebody said the word authoritarian, or you made references to purges, but like, I don't know, yeah, the people were not treated well in the organization, and this thing called the game and that stuff.
That stuff's all in there, and you
that's
know,
in the
that's,
book.
It's yeah, and you can read about it. But I think that it has to be taken in context. And I mean, he was committed to the idea of a movement, and many of the people around him were as well. They thought there was a way for this to coexist, and maybe there was a way for it to coexist at some point, but not with the staffing levels that the union had. And I mean, to go back to the legal department, he loved the legal department when they were fighting. You know, everything was wonderful when they were in fighting mode. When the legal department was supposed to be, you know, negotiating, administering contracts and doing things like that, he wasn't that interested in it. He referred to that as non-missionary work. And so, you know, he was struggling, and you see, I mean, again, I go back to these tapes, but, you know, he brings in people to talk about the science of management. I mean, he understood the problem that they were facing, and he wrestled with it, and he tries to create a structure. And he explains to people that under this new thing called the science of management, you have to be able to delegate and then, delegate responsibility and then hold people accountable. And that's how you make the thing work. Great. He can't do it. You know, I mean, he tries and he just can't delegate that level of authority. And, you know, and he believed, I mean, he explored setting up a religious order for farm workers, and he believed in cooperatives, and he was sort of searching for something that would be the next thing for him, and he never quite got there. But I think also when I learned about his earlier years and how he learned to organize and the house meetings and the one-on-one contact and setting up these things he called the problem clinic, I think in some ways he was the happiest, you know, when things were small and he had a problem clinic and people came to him and he talked to them, and he liked to say that he didn't want to set time. He didn't believe in appointments because you should talk to somebody for as long as it took to work out their problem. Well, that's great, but if you're running, you know, a union and a health plan and a pension plan and whatever, it's a little hard to operate that way. So that's kind of the run-up to it.
I told Caesar along the way that early on, I said, you are our Benito Juarez. And I've since learned how right that was for me anyway. The fact that Benito Juarez was president of Mexico, of course, when the French invaded and put Maximilian as the emperor of Mexico, and Juarez carrying the legitimate governor of Mexico in his carriage, went all over the republic to escape the French, but also to keep the government going, all the way to Juarez. That's why it's called Juarez. It was El Paso del Norte at the time. And then he, when the French were finally kicked out in 1867, he came back and was president, and he died 5 years later of a heart attack at the same age that Caesar died, at 66. Interestingly enough, Carlotta died in 1927, the same year that Caesar was born. And what's happened to Juarez is that you see his statue all over Mexico. He's a Bienvenido de las Americas. He's the Indian face of Mexico. But Mexico is still not an Indian, a country that's kind to Indians. It's hostile to its Indians. This is why now, instead of people from the immediate northern border, we get farm workers coming all the way from Oaxaca, Mixtec Indians speaking Triqui. They don't even speak English or Spanish. And they're in the Salinas Valley now because they're coming from deep, the marrow of Mexico. These are Indians, indígenas, that are coming all the way to work as farm workers here. So that means that Mexico still owes a debt to its Indians, even though they push the Indian face of Juarez as the face of Mexico. I hope the same thing doesn't happen to Caesar, that he doesn't become our Benito Juarez as the only Indian, you know, representative of the Mexican Americans. We need a lot more leaders, men and women, that represent their people and have his courage and his persistence and his resilience to continue the struggle that he started, or that he continued, actually, in his lifetime. But we can't be satisfied with just one.
Okay, and with that, that's let me excellent.
One quick thing about charismatic leadership. No, because I think it goes to the point that you raised too, that he's not the first charismatic leader to be able to succeed in building something and then to struggle to run it. I mean, that's a very common historic paradigm, and that doesn't take away from his accomplishments in any way.
We have a very special treat to end this with. When Cesar Chavez died, and of course that was a really important moment in Luis's life, he wrote a eulogy, Canto a César, that he is going to share with us to end the program tonight.
I had to write it in longhand here off the internet. This was written literally the day that we went to La Paz to receive his body from Arizona. Canto a César. Elegy for Cesar Chavez. Cesar, we have come to plant your heart like a seed, as a great farm worker of the earth you always were. We have come to sing your song of struggle and sacrifice, triumphant in your pain. But you shall never die, my brother. The seed of your heart, like that of our beloved Emiliano, will keep on flowering, will keep on singing. We'll keep on marching for the cause of love and brotherhood. For now, you are a song, Caesar, and the smile of your eyes, like the compassion of your gentle hands, like the strong step of your farm worker feet, has become light, pure light of faith and deep understanding. And all the farm workers shall harvest in the field of your memory the fruits of your fine humanity as their daily bread. But there, in the seedbed of history, your myth shall grow upward like the tree of life, and you shall give light and shade to all humanity. You shall always lead us, my brother. Now you shall be like the sun that illuminates our path and like the wind that lifts us up to keep on planting, to keep on singing, to keep on struggling for your heart of peace and justice in the cause of unity and love.
Please join me in thanking Miriam and Luis.
Thank you all for coming.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.